In Tommy's mind, the odds that this site was the wreck of the Central America had jumped dramatically the moment they saw the side wheels almost 2 weeks earlier, and with each successive dive, he had become more convinced. But it was infinitely more difficult to excite his investors with another chain of circumstantial evidence than it was to say to them, "Here's the bell from the SS Central America." It wasn't gold, but it was the next best thing. "That really confirmed it," said Tommy. The day after they recovered the bell, the weather crept back up to 15-knot winds and 6-foot seas, still low enough to launch and recover the vehicle. But that day they did not dive. They waited for parts from the beach. On September 27th, regardless of the seas hitting 5 to 8 feet, they launched the vehicle at 9:30 in the morning. "I remember the day quite clearly," said Moore, "because they were very interested in this one spot, and we could see some bright stuff." As Moore flew the vehicle slowly toward the beam, Tommy said, "This is it, right here. It's one of those." Moore eased down closer. "It's that thing sticking right out on the end there," said Deering. Down closer, the beam looked almost like the head of a mythic animal, its mouth open, a gargoyle jutting out from the front of an old library. Everyone watched the monitors as Moore eased the vehicle closer and closer, and Milt snapped pictures. "It's these bright things right here," said Tommy, pointing at the monitor. "Those things here are what we're..." His voice trailed off. "Boy, look at that." "What do you think of that, Bob?" "In this area and anything else like this," said Bob, "it's deceiving." "Those are the droppings of the infamous tube worms," said Moore. "I don't think so," said Tommy. "Yep," said Moore. "We have lots of tube worms that are exactly that color in the photographs." "I don't think so," Tommy said again. "Yep," said Moore. "They're tube worms." "Okay," said Tommy. "Down on that, there are tube worms," Moore finished. The vehicle was rotating slowly to the right, the cameras looking into a depression where they saw many short, straight, gray lines, like small bricks covered with dust. "What I find interesting," said Moore, "are those blocks right there." Milt fired the cameras at the depression several times, and Moore got increasingly excited about what he was seeing. "I don't give a shit about your tube worms," he said, "but those are goddamn bricks. I don't know if they're bricks out of an oven or bricks out of a boiler, but those are goddamn bricks right there. And that's where I'd go down and take a look." Milt shot another 43 photos around the gargoyle before the power blew in the subsea computer and they had to end the dive. That night they worked on the vehicle, and the next morning they were on deck again at 7 o'clock, continuing their work. Although the seas were 8 feet, they would try to launch. At mid-morning, Milt began preparing the cameras for the dive, and Deering went to the darkroom to develop the film of the gargoyle from the previous day. Deering knew they had had problems with the camera during the dive, but when he saw the black strips of film, he was so disgusted with himself and the cameras, he left the other film cassette in the darkroom, locked the door, and went to the galley for lunch. After lunch, he returned to the photo lab. When he pulled the film from the chemical bath, he glanced at the strips to see if he had images. He laid one of the strips on the light table to check the exposure. For over 15 years, Deering had been looking at things underwater. But nothing prepared him for what now lay on the light table waiting for his eye. He placed the loop over one of the pictures, and in a twinkling, appeared the most spectacular sight he had ever seen. It was just covered with gold. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. That was the most thrilling. He had hit right on a pile. Nice low pictures. Nice and clear. I mean, everything was perfect, man. It was incredible. But I looked at it, and I looked up, and, "Nah, this can't be," I thought. "That's got to be a bunch of brass laying there." So I looked again and, holy, I just started looking at the other strips and I mean it was piles. I'm not kidding you. It was awesome. It was absolutely awesome. Stacks of gold and bars of gold of every size and shape just sitting there. Deering picked up that 5-foot strip, grabbed the loop, and took the steps two at a time up to the next deck, where he found Tommy and Barry in the communications room. The door was open, so he walked in and ceremoniously closed the door behind him. "I'm telling you, my heart was pounding," he remembered. "I mumbled something incoherent like, wah, wah, wah." He handed the strip to Tommy, who held it up to the light. Deering heard Tommy say something like, "Boy, I never thought..." And then he heard a yahoo. "God, he was happy," said Deering. "We were just on top of the world. We had done it. We had found it." Before they could launch the vehicle, the weather dropped. For 3 days, the sea rolled in at 8 to 10 feet, and the wind peaked at 30 knots. Now in October, the seas remained at 5 to 8 feet, and the wind came in at a stiff 20 to 25 knots. They launched on the morning of the 1st anyhow, and the vehicle arrived on the bottom at 9:19, suspended just above the area that they now called the Bank of California. After they had surveyed the scene for 10 minutes, Moore eased the vehicle lower and settled in next to an area Tommy had selected to begin their photography. It was safe and at the edge of what looked like a dense concentration of gold. The piles of coins and bars that had shocked Deering still lay mostly covered with sediment. Moore aimed the forward thruster downward and dispatched a gentle wash of water to blow away the cover material. For several minutes, the techs could see nothing but roiling sediment. Then the monitors began to clear, and slowly revealed was a scene few people could imagine. "The bottom was carpeted with gold," said Tommy. "Gold everywhere, like a garden. The more you looked, the more you saw gold growing out of everything, embedded in all the wood and beams. It was amazing. Clear back in the far distance, bars stacked on the bottom like brownies. Bars stacked like loaves of bread. Bars that appeared to have slid into the corner of a room. Some of the bars formed a bridge. All gold bars spanning one area of treasure over here and another area over here. Water underneath and the decks collapsed through on both sides. Then there was a beam with coins stacked on it. Just covered. Couldn't see the top of the beam. It had so many coins on it." "There's so much of it," said Deering, "and it's shiny, and some of it's real bright, and some of it sparkles at you, and some of it has this reddish cast to it. Beautiful hues, all unmistakable. I want to pick it up. I want to bring it home." "Look at those damn fire bricks," laughed Moore. Milt saw a collection of bars and coins watched over by a pink-orange anemone softly fluttering in the current. "Boy, that's nice," he said. Sticking up out of another area was a coin tower. 8 stacks of gold coins, 25 coins to a stack, all of the stacks abutting one another like poker chips still in the rack. In a couple of hard days, they could have grabbed every brick and most of the coins, but Tommy wanted the scene fully documented before they touched anything. Then he wanted to document the recovery of each bar and each coin carefully, one at a time. "Harv's rationale," said Deering, "was that this is the last time this gold will ever be in this untampered state. That you can't have too many pictures of it, 'cause you'll never have that opportunity again." Couldn't agree with him more. So we started taking photographs, and we took photographs, and we took photographs, and we kept on taking. "Okay, Harv, we got 1,000 photographs from every conceivable angle, every conceivable lighting situation. Let's start picking this stuff up." He wouldn't do it. For hours, they filmed and photographed the scene before Tommy directed Moore to recover a coin. They continued to shoot and retrieve until bottom-side computer problems forced them to end the dive. Before the vehicle ascended, they had 27 gold artifacts, and for every artifact they had collected, they had shot nearly 10 photographs. Early the following morning, the tech crew was on deck, dismantling the subsea computer and rebuilding it with parts delivered the night before. Milt had returned to the beach on the delivery boat to resume his teaching responsibilities at the University of South Carolina. All day, the rest of the crew worked in seas rocking 4 to 8 feet and winds gusting to 20 knots. That evening, they prepared to launch again, but Tommy himself canceled the dive when the weather appeared to be dropping. At sunup the next day, the crew stood on deck ready to launch. But as Deering raised the vehicle from the deck and rotated the crane slowly over the water, a gear at the base of the crane cracked under the weight and a moment later blew apart. The vehicle skimmed the waves and crashed into the bulwark. Moore tested the systems and, except for reduced power with a lost battery pack, everything seemed to work. On the bottom, they fired the cameras every 30 seconds, but they started losing hydraulic pressure. Then, part of their subsea navigation blew. The dive ended at 3 in the afternoon. Tommy still wanted hundreds of more photos of the Bank of California area, but one of his objectives on the next dive was to recover gold. Early the morning of the 6th, a squall of 20-knot winds passed over them in the dark, but by daybreak the sea again had dropped. At 11:35, they launched the repaired vehicle. As the dive continued throughout the afternoon, the swell's topside gradually sharpened and turned gray. Just before 5 o'clock, at Tommy's direction, Moore slowly opened the artifact drawer. He removed the trays, placing them at the edge of the gold pile. Using a fingertip touch, like he was playing a flute, Moore moved the master arm on his console, and the manipulator on the vehicle reached out over a pile of coins, spread its Teflon jaws, closed them, paused again, and lifted a single coin. When Moore opened the jaws again above the tray, the coin dropped and a tiny cloud of sediment rose. They shot each scene 3 or 4 times, then Moore plucked a coin or a bar from the scene, slowly cleaning up a discrete concentration at the edge of the gold spill. At sunset, out beyond the far edge of the Gulf Stream, Burlingham saw clouds building and estimated this squall line was as close as 25 miles. He radioed the control room. "You better bring it up now." Tommy heard the warning but continued to work. He needed to recover a significant amount of gold, yet do it carefully. By 6 o'clock, they had recovered 7 artifacts. By 8 p.m., they had picked up 32 altogether. Burlingham recorded in his log that the wind had risen sharply to a steady 20 to 25 knots, the seas more consistent now at 6 feet. And according to the latest weather facts, the disturbance he had seen along the horizon at sunset was no squall, but a frontal system that had formed suddenly and appeared huge. The sea and the wind could still double in size and intensity. He radioed the control room again. "Harvey," he said, "this front's going to be on us in 2 hours. We should start recovery operations immediately." "We're on to something important," said Tommy. "Fine," said Burlingham. "We're going to be running 10 to 15-foot seas." Burlingham didn't need to tell Tommy what that meant. 10-foot seas made recovery almost impossible, and once the storm hit, it would be too late to begin. The winch took an hour and a half to wind 8,000 feet of cable to the surface. Then they had to raise the vehicle with the crane and swing it onto the deck, but Tommy decided to stay down just a little longer. At the center of the ship, the heavy insulation that kept the control room cool and dry also deadened the sound and feel of the sea. Other than the slight rocking, the tech crew had no sense of the approaching storm. For another hour, they remained on the bottom. By 9 o'clock, the seas had reached 8 feet and the wind blew at near gale. At 10:30, the vehicle neared the surface. By then, the wind had intensified to full gale and the waves had grown by over half. They stopped the vehicle 30 feet beneath the surface. Crouching on his hands and knees, Brian lifted himself over the bulwark onto the hero boards just as the ship dropped away and a 12-foot sea hit broadside, ripping his hand from the platform. The wave exploded off the ship, jerking him up the cable, but Brian held tight to the cable and the wave fell away as Todd dropped onto the boards next to him. Deering had fought his way across the deck to the crane, and everyone else on the tech crew was holding tight to the bulwark with one hand and hanging on to Todd, Brian, and Burlingham with the other. Deering had the crane lowered over the water, winching the vehicle higher. With the vehicle rising at the top of the crane, the ship began to roll to starboard, and the crane began to turn. And then Todd heard a loud pop and saw the vehicle hurtling at him. He threw himself over the rail and scrambled aft as the vehicle skimmed the water and crashed into the deployment arm, the electronic spheres exploding, the gold sparks showering the deck. The ship rolled back to port, the vehicle twisting out over the water at the top of the crane, and then the ship rolled back to starboard and the vehicle crashed again into the deployment arm. Flashes lit up the port side and more sparks shot into the air. The batteries inside the vehicle's battery packs ripped loose from their brackets and packs broke open, spraying oil across the deck. To try to control the swing, Bob reached up with a boat hook and snagged a tag line coming off the side of the crane. The other techs grabbed hold and heaved together, stumbling and sliding on the oil-slick deck, trying to haul the line toward the starboard rail. But before they could pull it that far, the vehicle began its outward swing, dragging 6 of them back across the deck. Deering was trying to raise the crane high enough so that on its next swing in, the vehicle would clear the rail and he could drop it on the deck. But as he tried, the crane's motor suddenly died, and the knuckle locked in that bent position with the 2.5-ton vehicle slamming against the side of the ship. Deering could not control the crane. He jumped from the seat and grabbed onto the tagline with the others. Harvey was in the thick of it, running back and forth, said Moore. Moore jumped onto the crane's seat. He couldn't control the swing, but if he could straighten the knuckle on the next swing, the vehicle might be just high enough to clear the bulwark. And once it was over the deck, he could let the cable out and try to drop it, trapping it inside the rails. But Moore had never operated the crane, and he couldn't tell which lever straightened the knuckle. On the next roll to port, Moore waited until the crane reached its zenith, jammed the lever he thought might control the knuckle, and the knuckle began to straighten, raising the vehicle as it swung back toward the ship. Bob heard a loud thud and then voices shouting, saw that the vehicle twisting wildly on the boom had skipped over the port gunwale and was flying across the deck. Tommy ducked and stumbled forward. Bob dropped the tagline and dived inside an empty aluminum cube pinned against the starboard rail. The vehicle swept the space where they had stood, then twisted at the end of the boom and began swinging back across the deck, over the gunwale, out across the water. Moore had tried to drop crane as the vehicle came over the deck, but the crane moved too slowly. Moore raised the deployment arm again so it would clear the rail coming in, and he could try once more to drop it on the deck. This time the vehicle bounced off the gunwale, continued across the deck, and had begun its outboard swing when Moore slammed the lever, dropping the whole boom down on top of the vehicle. The vehicle slammed into the deck, skidded toward the port rail, hit, skidded back toward the center of the deck, then headed again toward the port rail and crashed into the base of the deployment arm where it stopped. Suddenly the tagline went limp. Despite the wind and the waves and the falling rain, the night seemed still. No one spoke. Exhausted and shaking, they stood in the rain, not moving. "It was the strangest feeling," said Todd. "Just a rush. We all looked around and everybody made it alive, and we started laughing. Maybe we were all delirious, I don't know. Then for some reason, I remember looking over and I saw Harvey, who was shaking from the cold. I'll never forget that, because he had the biggest smile on his face." Although much of the vehicle had been destroyed and the artifact drawer was smashed closed, they had the vehicle safely aboard. The ship was rolling so hard that it took another 3 hours until the vehicle was snug in its parking place. With the vehicle strapped tight to the deck, the Arctic Discoverer traveled through the storm at 8 knots, headed due west for Wilmington. Historically, when someone discovers a large cache of gold, one of three things happens. Storytellers refer to them as curses. One, in their rush to grab, the discoverers pathetically rebury the treasure or destroy it. Tommy had been careful from the beginning, some would say to a fault, to avoid this. Two, the one who finds the treasure dies trying to recover it. Although some of the crew were fond of saying, "God watches over little kids, drunks, and Harvey," Tommy knew his limits, even though he might push them beyond where most people would. Sometimes the one who found the treasure died at the hands of another. John Moore had once said, "With that much gold on board, a lot of people would think nothing of boarding us and killing the entire crew." The third fate, the secret leaks so fast and people flock to the site in such large numbers that they either dilute the treasure, greatly diminishing its value, or they overrun the claim of the original finder and take it away. Of course, there were more subtle ways that this could occur than trying to drag a sonar fish across your site. This was the one, that someone might try to take it away, that concerned Tommy the most. More immediately, what do you do with the gold right now? "There's no precedent," said Bob, "for taking several tons of gold in small parcels off the ocean floor, moving it to shore, and securing it. When you get to port, you can't leave it on the ship, but if you try to take it off, someone will see you. Where do you take it? You can't put it in the bank. In 1857, stacking all of that gold on top of itself to be transported would not diminish its value. But 130 years later, the value of that gold as historical artifacts has risen dramatically. So now each piece must be individually and carefully handled. And if there's lots more where this came from, how do you tell the story to certain people who deserve to know about your find without people you don't want to know about it finding out? And if you think the way Tommy thinks, you can conjure infinitely more problems that could lead to the loss of the treasure." When he returned to Columbus in late October, Tommy scheduled a meeting of the partnership for Saturday, November 26th. Wayne Ashby described the gathering as a very excited and happy group of investors. Tommy stood at the podium, his black beard thick from months at sea. A few feet from Tommy sat the bell from the Central America. On a table in front of Tommy sat an aquarium filled with water, and in the water sat a bar of gold weighing 25 pounds. Back in Wilmington, after the storm, Tommy had sent each partner a series of letters. One reconstructing the recovery of the bell, one describing a bar of gold, and another telling the story of the two gold coins they had found. As for the bar of gold, Tommy had written, "Our preliminary information indicates that only a few like it are still known to exist, because the government melted down most of them during and shortly after the Civil War period." In each letter, Tommy closed with an admonition. "It may seem impossible to keep a lid on our discoveries until next summer. Keep in mind that our partnership has done other things that are still considered impossible. We all must be patient until the rest of the gold is in hand. Once this critical path goal is met, then we can safely go public with our discoveries." For security reasons, Tommy could not reveal even to the partnership the fairy tale scenes of gold that he and the tech crew had witnessed at the site. Revealing the recovery of only one bar and two coins offered the perfect compromise, just what the partners needed to provide them with a sense of wonder and excitement and to enjoy their role in the accomplishment, and the ideal cover if the information that they had found gold ever did leak out. If anyone in the treasure hunting community heard that Tommy had recovered one gold bar and two gold coins, they would immediately assume that Tommy had salted the wreck site, a ploy that treasure hunters were notorious for. Wave a gold coin in front of a potential investor and tell him there were lots just like it on a ship they had found. They just needed a little more cash to fund an expedition to go get it. But the partners had sensed that it was not a treasure hunt, that it was an expedition to a new frontier, and that the man leading the expedition had a vision. The confidence had begun with Dean Glower, who had connected Tommy with some of the most influential people in Columbus, including Wayne Ashby, who provided Tommy with a stage to present his ideas, a place to impress men like Arthur Coleman, Bill Arthur, and Buck Patton, and eventually over 100 others. From the $7.5 million stock offering the previous spring, they had sold units totaling only $3.5 million. Within 1 week of the partnership meeting, they had oversubscribed the remaining $4 million. Now Tommy had the money to build an even bigger, more complex, and more capable vehicle to explore the site further and recover the rest of the gold. And next season there would be no competitors, no rush to get to sea, no wondering if he was on the right wreck. One of the more remarkable accomplishments of the Columbus America Discovery Group is that from October 1988, when Tommy announced to the partners in a letter that they had found gold, until September 1989, when they finally announced to the public that they had recovered the treasure of the Central America, that news never traveled outside the partnership, an organization of 160 individuals, most of whom did not know one another. For that year, the partners' commitment to secrecy allowed Tommy and his tech crew to concentrate on refining their technology and returning to the site for further exploration and recovery. Through the winter and spring of 1989, Tommy directed Hackman, Scotty, and John Moore and other engineers from Battelle in designing, building, and testing a new vehicle. In the late spring, Tommy drove his mentor, Dean Glower, out to the warehouse to show him the vehicle. "When I first looked at it," said Glower, "I was in a state of shock. It's an enormous design." Glower was struck by the vehicle's complexity and its place in history. "Almost like designing and building the first automobile," said Glower. His question to Tommy in 1973, "How are we going to work in the deep ocean?" had led to a 2.5-ton vehicle that eventually would grow to 6 tons. It was the design Tommy had envisioned 5 years earlier. On March 23, 1989, Judge Kellum enlarged Columbus America's legally protected area to include the Galaxy 2 site. 3 months later, the court awarded Columbus America exclusive salvage rights to the new site, as well as title to the artifacts they had already recovered. The shipwreck at Galaxy 1, the site of the original injunction, now appears to be a mid-19th century collier, perhaps on its way to Havana to restock coal supplies. In September of 1989, the Columbus America Discovery Group announced the find to the public, and on October 5th, they sailed into Norfolk, Virginia aboard the Arctic Discoverer. The day was Indian summer blue with just enough chill to freshen the air. Waiting for them on the dock were the Captain William Lewis Herndon High School Marching Band, the Norfolk Police, and the Norfolk Mayor, three Brinks armored cars and security guards, descendants of passengers and crew aboard the Central America, several hundred onlookers, and over 200 family members, investors, office workers, friends, and consultants. In the crowd also were representatives from 39 insurance companies claiming that all the gold aboard the Central America belonged to them. Before he left Columbus to return to sea the summer of 1989, Tommy consulted with a coin expert from New York named James Lamb. When Lamb examined an 1857 S Double Eagle $20 gold piece, he pronounced it gem quality. A numismatist can go through an entire career and see about two of these coins in this condition, Lamb said. Many of the coins had been struck by small private mints, and coinage produced by these mints was extremely rare. Lamb cautioned that the sheer quantity of coins would affect their value. But really, he added, we've got no idea how the market will react to this. Even if they only bring up relatively large quantities of relatively common coins, they are still going to change the structure of U.S. numismatics significantly. For months, Lamb had seen only gold coins. He knew nothing about the bars. Aboard the Arctic Discoverer, in the fall of 1989, James Lamb saw bars for the first time in Bob Evans' small lab. This is the most extraordinary, most incredible, most exciting thing ever. It's impossible to describe the significance, the potential monetary value, the general excitement of this find. It's beyond imagination. If I didn't have it sitting here in front of me, then I wouldn't believe it. Tommy continues to explore the ultimate disposition of the treasure. The quality of the pieces and their rarity make them valuable to numismatists, which will increase the premium over bullion value dramatically. And the story of how they were lost and how they were found again is certain to expand the circle of those wanting to own a piece of the treasure far beyond coin collectors. The value of the treasure will remain undetermined until Tommy decides how Columbus America should dispose of it. In August 1990, Judge Kellum heard the claims of the insurance companies, decided the case under the law of fines, held that over 132 years the insurance companies had made no effort to recover the gold and therefore had abandoned, the key word, their claim to the gold, and he awarded the Columbus America Discover Group 100% of all the artifacts at the Central America site. On appeal to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel, in a split decision handed down on August 26, 1992, vacated and remanded the case to Judge Kellum for another trial under the law of salvage. For 2 weeks, Judge Kellum heard evidence of the difficulty of the salvage, the expense, the risk to life and to capital. The court found that Columbus America's efforts to preserve the site and the artifacts have not been equaled in any other case. At the end of the trial, Judge Kellum awarded Columbus America 90% of the insured gold and 100% of the rest of the treasure. He reserved judgment on the remaining 10% of the insured gold. The Fourth Circuit affirmed Judge Kellum in all respects. The court closed with these words, "What Thompson and Columbus America have accomplished is, by any other measure, extraordinary. We can say without hesitation that their story is a paradigm of American initiative, ingenuity, and determination." Bob Evans became so immersed in the stories of the passengers aboard the Central America, he sometimes daydreamed of finding things he had read about in the stories. In 1990, they recovered the first trunk. It was the same trunk they had first observed in 1988. Lying in the debris field next to the white teacup. Later, under the supervision of a polymer chemist from Ohio State's Department of Textiles and Clothing, Bob examined the contents. Among the many artifacts, they found silk cravats, waistcoats, petticoats, and bloomers. They also found a brace of dueling pistols, a gold watch fob, and two quill pens. The trunk is an archaeological treasure, a time capsule sealed in the late summer of 1857, and every item in it belonged to the newlyweds Hattie and Ansel Easton. Much of it gifts from friends, wishing them a lifetime of happiness together. One perspective on this achievement. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy told a joint session of Congress that the United States should commit itself to landing a man on the moon within a decade. For the next 8 years, over 400,000 people spent nearly $100 billion, current value, to put Neil Armstrong on the moon. Many scientists and engineers consider the challenges of exploring and working in the deep ocean equal to the challenges of exploring and working in outer space. In 1985, Tommy Thompson and about a dozen colleagues committed to putting a robot to work on the bottom of the deep ocean. No one had done it. No one knowledgeable thought it could be done without the full force of the United States government and unlimited resources. Even then, some were skeptical because the government had already spent millions trying. Despite legal challenges, a time frame of only 3 years, the efforts of about 30 people, and a budget of no more than $12 million, Tommy and his group had proved the experts wrong. You could work on the bottom of the deep ocean, do intricate work carefully, heavy work easily, and you didn't have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to do it. You just had to shed old ways of thinking and re-examine old assumptions. You had to keep diverging, even beyond the point where it all became difficult and confusing. That's where Tommy lived, and he made those around him live there too. Finding the treasure of the Central America was a goal, but it wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to unveil the treasures of the deep ocean, to enhance our understanding of history, to advance marine archaeology, to further science, to develop technology. Tommy had broached the idea during the roundtables back in 1985. If you do that, he said, all kinds of things can blossom.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.